Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. The 2020 November election promises to be the most unique in Pennsylvania and the nation's history. A presidential election is historic anyway, but we've never had a presidential election during a worldwide pandemic. There will be fewer polling places because there aren't enough poll workers. Many Americans won't vote in person because they fear contracting the coronavirus or don't want to wait in line what could be long lines. The number of people voting by mail or by absentee ballot will set records by far. And oh, by the way, some don't have confidence in how we'll vote this fall, including the President of the United States. Pennsylvania is an important state in this year's election, and that's one of the reasons challenges are being made to how votes are cast and counted. Join us to update us on the situation in Pennsylvania is PA Post reporter Emily Previty, who covers election-related stories and issues for PA Post. Emily, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalk. WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so the broad question, Emily, what are the potential problems, issues that could negatively affect voters in November here in Pennsylvania?
So those that are kind of taking center stage in Pennsylvania right now are connected in large part to the pandemic. That could, it probably will be a major issue still, leading up to the general election and through it. So that could mean needing to consolidate polling places again, as we did during the primary, and certainly poll workers needing to be extra careful during in-person voting with making sure that they maintain social distancing, that voters do that, frequent disinfecting of equipment that needs to be shared, such as touchscreen voting machines, and ensuring that there's enough PPE to last everyone all day. So, masks, gloves, hand sanitizer. And all of that, to go back to the social distancing and the frequent disinfecting, that could mean longer lines than usual, which we saw to a limited extent during the primary in parts of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. But for a higher turnout election, it looks like it could be, the waits could be longer. So many voters, because of the pandemic, will want to do a mail ballot, and there are concerns already with the timely receipt of ballots given the upheaval at the U.S. Postal Service and delivery delays that we're already seeing in Philly and elsewhere, which could lead to delayed results or ballots not making it back in time and voter disenfranchisement that way. Also, if voters have cast their ballot and they're concerned it won't arrive on time, they're allowed to cast a provisional ballot at the polls during in-person voting. And we saw an increase in the number of provisional ballots that were cast in many counties during the primary. And so if you're unfamiliar with that, a provisional ballot, basically it's a process that's separate from typical in-person voting. So it takes up more time because the poll worker has to explain the process to the voter. The voter has to fill out an affidavit. And then when that ballot is processed back at the main county elections office, the election workers need to make sure that that person, that basically that their vote isn't double counted, that they don't vote twice. So with provisionals being a remedy for voters who haven't received their mail ballot before the election or are worried that if they've sent it back, it won't make it through the mail in time, that all could exacerbate the delays at the polls and counting ballots and finalizing results. So
there's a lot of uncertainty, which is not good for voter confidence or even the confidence in the whole system. What's being done to address what's going on?
So the Department of State about 10 days ago announced that it's going to cover the cost of postage. So that's one less thing for the voter to worry about as far as buying a stamp. So they'll potentially get their ballot in the mail faster. Counties also will have the option of using the Department of State's business reply mail account to facilitate that, or their own if they have one. The Department of State and other officials have also been messaging, you know, encouraging voters to apply now to vote by mail on social media. And earlier this week, they announced a partnership with the Pittsburgh Penguins on an awareness campaign, and that's expected to expand to include other professional sports organizations in the state as well. And the legislature is discussing changing some rules pertaining to mail ballots, particularly the application and return deadlines. So there's a wider gap, and voters aren't applying to vote by mail for a week before their ballot has to be back, because that's not enough time, not safely anyway, according to the delivery estimates from the Postal Service. The ballot turnaround time was tight even before the surge in vote by mail, and recent cutbacks at USPS that are coinciding with increased mail volume during the pandemic. Counties have wanted lawmakers to clarify that, and there have been lawsuits in the past over the ballot turnaround time. So the other issues that the state legislature is debating and has been debating, polling place consolidation. There were rules that were enacted in response to the pandemic for the primary, but they were only temporary and they've expired. And that one of the things that counties may want the flexibility to do is to assign poll workers to polling places other than their own. Also, if voters want to drop off their mail ballots at the polls or the county elections office or a drop box located elsewhere, what's permissible under the law? Some counties say it's clear to them that they can use drop boxes, for example, but others say they're not so sure.
Well, the legislature has to act on some of these things, as you just described, but they're not in session and they haven't dealt with these issues, at least it finalized some of these issues up until now. So what's the time frame for maybe some of these things happening, and is there support?
So there's support, but the devil is in the details, as they say. So as far as timing, the House Majority Leader, Kerry Benioff from Center County, told PCN last week that, and I confirmed it with his office thereafter, that he's hoping to call people back to session for the end of the month, late August, and if there's consensus. But that has not been reached, at least not at last check. And, you know, for example, we've been talking about the mail ballot deadlines. The chairman of the House State Government Committee, where a bunch of this legislation has originated and is currently up for debate, he's said that he thinks bumping the receipt deadline for mail ballots by a few days, as suggested by the Department of State, wouldn't be too controversial. But in addition to that, the Republicans would want the vote by mail application deadline to move back to 2 weeks out from the election versus 7 days as it is now. And so they basically, you know, the Democrats don't want to make that move on the mail ballot deadline, mail ballot application deadline. So that's just an example of, we're sort of getting into the weeds here, but that's kind of where some of the debates and, the lack of consensus is rooted.
Bottom line, I mean, from the people you've talked to, if the legislature decides to deal with these issues in late August, is that enough time before the November election?
I've been told yes. In a report on the primary that the Department of State put out on August 1st that included, as I said, the recommendation for moving the mail ballot return deadline to the Friday after the election, they also made sure to specify these laws need to be effective in early September in order for counties to be able to implement them in time. And the county election directors have said we're not out of time yet, but we're looking at an effective date of early September. Coming back in late August does seem to be cutting it close, even if it's not technically too late. And of course, the uncertainty hanging over all of this, as you've said, complicates planning at the county level for administering this election.
Before we go to how the counties are preparing for this, there are a number of lawsuits that are election related. So tell us about some of those lawsuits and some of the impact that those suits may have.
So there are 8 different lawsuits that are pending right now over election issues in Pennsylvania, but we can just focus on some of the higher profile ones and those that are moving and could or are expected to potentially have an impact. So the one that many of us have probably already heard about is the President's Reelection Campaign. It's a federal lawsuit seeking a court order that would limit polling places or would limit the drop-off of mailed ballots to county elections offices only, or just clarify what's allowed in that regard, but to exclude drop boxes that are located away from a government center, which we saw in some counties during the primary. There were drop boxes at libraries and shopping centers, and there were some mobile drop boxes as well. So looking to eliminate those, and then the lawsuit is also seeking a requirement for counties to reject mailed ballots if they arrive without their internal secrecy envelope. Mailed ballots have 2 envelopes, the internal one that has no identifying information about the voter, and then the external one, which has like postage, address, return address, and a barcode, just so, you know, the county can account for its arrival, but not what, you know, that it's been voted, but not how it's been voted, essentially. And the other thing is they want campaigns to be able to assign poll watchers anywhere in the state versus only their county of residence, which is what it's limited to now. And the most recent one to be filed was filed last Friday by the League of Women Voters. They are basically suing over counties rejecting ballots with a signature that doesn't match what they have on file without counting the voter to try to attempt to have that fixed, basically, rather than just tossing the ballot. And many counties told me that they already do that with varying degrees of success. It's limited because voters do not have to put their phone number or email address in their registration. But if they have that information, they certainly will use it. And if there's enough time, they'll attempt to contact voters by mail. But again, that's not a requirement, which is what this League of Women Voters lawsuit is seeking, to require counties to contact voters in the event of a signature mismatch rather than just discarding the ballot.
Wow.
So those are 2. And then there are also, you know, there's one that was filed in state court by the Pennsylvania Democratic Party that is an answer or essentially meant to counter the President's reelection campaign lawsuit in federal court. So, for example, they're seeking a court order that would clarify counties can decide how to collect mailed ballots through other means than the mail, and that campaigns, poll watchers do need to be limited to working in their county of residence. And there's yet another lawsuit is filed by the Pennsylvania Alliance of Retired Americans, which was actually initiated during the general election, during the primary, and then revived for the general, or in hopes of making changes before the general to the mailed ballot deadlines. And they actually want a return deadline of 1 week after the election.
Wait, let's take a phone call from Charlie. Charlie, you're on the air.
Good morning, Scott and Emily.
Good morning.
I understand Governor Wolf has arranged that there will be prepaid postage on our mail-in ballots for Pennsylvania. I thought I'd heard, I don't remember which state it was, but another state in their primary, they also had that prepaid postage on. And sometimes the U.S. Postal System, which is getting very involved in our election this year, sometimes has a tendency to skip over and not postmark prepaid envelopes. Do we know whether this is going to be reconciled between Pennsylvania's ballots and the U.S. Postal Service, that those prepaid postage would be postmarked with a date on, because properly postmarked ballots could come into play for being counted maybe after the election day?
Charlie, that's a good question. Emily, is that something that you've dealt with?
So I'm not familiar with which state the caller is referring to, but I do know that I asked about that within the past couple of weeks, and the Department of State, they are using something called an intelligent barcode. So there would be a record of the ballot being scanned and being received by the Postal Service. I'm not sure regarding the postmark, and again, any kind of remedy that's specific to making sure that the postmark itself that would be visible isn't skipped over, but that's certainly something worth clarifying in addition to the intelligent barcode.
One final question for you, Emily. How are counties getting ready for the election other than all the things they're facing right now?
So the Philadelphia Inquirer reported last week that Philadelphia and some of the suburban counties have been exploring setting up early voting sites, and certainly counties are considering mailing out ballot applications that would just go out to all voters automatically to cut down on processing requests. So those are some of the things that are being explored at the moment. But really, in addition to that, election directors and county officials are trying to, as they have been, just be vocal about what changes that they think need to be made ahead of the next election to their commissioners and the state legislature.
Mm. Emily Previty covers election-related topics for PA Post, and you can read more about some of Emily's stories at papost.org. PA Post is a statewide news digital first organization operated by WITF. Emily, there's a lot to cover here, a lot going on. Thank you very much for your insight into what's going on. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lear.
Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we're going to have an infectious disease specialist on the program to update us on the latest information, research, treatment options, what's going on with COVID-19. That's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in. Only 5% of freshwater creeks and streams in the United States are named, an important distinction for water conservation and pollution control. Water quality experts say that named streams are more likely to be protected from litter and unwanted runoff. So what goes into naming creeks and waterways? Joining us is Jennifer Runyon, senior researcher with the U.S. Board on Geographic Names. Ms. Runyon, welcome to the program. Jennifer Runyon, are you there?
Good morning. Thank you.
Yes. If you have a question or a comment, this is a fascinating topic. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Jennifer Runyon, I have to say I was surprised, and everyone I've talked to about this says the same thing, that they are really kind of surprised that only 5% of freshwater creeks and streams in the U.S. have names. How could that happen or not happen?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and the reality is we don't really have an inventory of all the named streams. Well, sorry, let me back up. We do have an inventory of named streams. We don't have an inventory of all the existing streams. So it's really hard to really do a percentage. But one thing that the U.S. Board on Geographic Names here, we partner closely with the National Hydrography Data Set, and it is their job to manage all streams in the nation, water quality, stream flow, map, the mouth and the source. So working with them, yes, they came up with that percentage, or at least confirmed that it's probably pretty close. But you think about all the tiny tributaries of every creek and river in the state, and really nothing is too small to be named. So yes, indeed, if you were to count up every one of those little tributaries and then count up how many we have named in the state, it is a very small percentage. You're right.
So does that include, when we say unnamed, do streams waterways have to have an official name? Or, I mean, I'm sure locals, people who live in a local area have lived there for a long time. You know, if there's a stream or a creek running through their area, probably call it something. Before we get into the exact process of how a waterway is named, historically, some of those historic names that locals use, are they included in this?
Yes and no. How's that for an answer? it is important to distinguish, certainly, yes. As far as we're concerned, it's only officially named if it's recognized by the federal government, the U.S. Board on Geographic Names, and you're absolutely right. There are going to be lots of names out there that the local community uses and has used for a long time. We've been collecting place names officially in a database, or if you want to call it before that, you know, printed gazetteers for over 40 years. But the Board on Geographic Names itself has been around since 1890. So we have a long history of applying names to geographic places, and of course it's not just streams, it would be all kinds of natural features from mountains and valleys and lakes and islands and bays and so forth. But the job of the board has been to either collect names that are already published, starting with federal maps. Many of your listeners are probably familiar with the U.S. Geological Survey topographic maps. And they've been around, of course, even longer than the board in 1879. And so we started in the late 70s collecting all the names that were shown on the topographic maps. And then we went back and added all the names that appeared on, for example, Forest Service maps, Park Service maps. And then we followed up with a more intense process with collecting names that we could find on local, state, county maps, place name histories, local published histories. So really for 130 years, our mission has been to collect names, and if they're in our official names database, then by definition they are official for federal use.
Maybe some definitions are in order here. You said just a few minutes ago that no waterway is too small. What is a stream? What constitutes a stream?
Basically, it's defined very broadly. It's just a free-flowing water body. A linear body of water flowing on the Earth's surface. So you're right. Nothing's too small. We have a stream in Oregon that our board named several years ago. It's called the Dee River. It's 300 feet long. So yes, if the local community feels that a tiny tributary needs a name, that our board will consider it. There's no limit. And these days with digital mapping where you can zoom in to amazingly large scales, and if there's a need to study that 300-foot stream for pollution, for just water quality in general, yes, you can name it, yes.
Now you said that in Oregon that 300-foot waterway was a river. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between a stream, creek, and river?
Absolutely nothing as far as we're concerned. There's a lot of local perception. People think they know what a creek is, and you sort of envision a river, you know, the big ones in the Susquehanna and so forth. But as far as our board is concerned, there is no official definition of a river versus a creek versus a brook, a run. It's very much locally driven. I like to give the example here in near our office in Northern Virginia. We have Little River flows into Goose Creek, which to some people might make no sense at all. But,
yeah, really.
because you sort of envision a river being bigger, but right. Not at all. And in fact, you think back to when these were named, and this would certainly be true in Pennsylvania too, that, you know, a name was applied by a very localized community. They didn't have a map. They didn't stop to see what was named up and downstream. And so if they wanted to call it Little River, and then another group in a community 5 miles downstream, so to speak, named theirs Goose Creek, you're going to wind up with a Little River flowing into Goose Creek. It wasn't like they got together and compared notes and said, you know, ours is bigger than yours. and we don't, it's not our business to dictate what defines a river versus a creek. So if the local community calls it a creek, so be it. And there are obviously regional variations.
We actually have an example here in central Pennsylvania recently that one of the, and it's a pretty large creek, the Swatara Creek, there were people who wanted it designated as a river.
Right.
And now, I don't know whether it was your agency or not, but that designation was turned down, and it remains Swatara Creek. How could that be?
It was probably, I'm just have to refresh my memory on this particular record, but certainly, yes, if the local community, and a big part of what we do, you know, again, we're basically sitting here meeting in Washington, D.C., and it's not our place to dictate what a name ought to be. We want to know what the local community thinks. So we spend a lot of time reaching out to local governments for their input. And in this case, we got a lot of response on this particular one. Some individuals, some groups were in favor of the change, but then you had, if I remember, some of the township governments. I'm thinking back, South Hanover, Derry, as I recall, South Swatara Township. They said, no, don't change the name. We're perfectly happy with Creek as it is. Again, we're not going to say, you know, that you need to change it. And the board is very conservative when it comes to changing names. We leave a name well enough alone unless there's really a compelling reason to change it. In this case, the board didn't see a compelling reason. As I recall, there was some argument that the name had to be changed to River because there were different designations at state level on how a name or a stream is preserved, depending on or classified, depending on how it's a river or a creek. But that's a state regulation or a state requirement. It's not something the federal government feels is critical. So there must have been more opposition to the change than support for the change.
Well, see, you just touched on my next question and why this is important. Okay, only 5% of streams that have names. Okay, that's a fascinating topic. A lot of people are probably running around when we get to the topic of how you can name a waterway, running around thinking, oh, here's what I'd like to name it. But why is this important?
Well, just to go back a little bit on the history of the board, again, I mentioned it was established in 1890, and it was done at a time when, if you think about the late 19th century, there was a lot of westward expansion. For the first time, you had government surveyors going out west, bringing back their reports and maps and sketches and turning them into the to the federal agencies that were making maps for the first time, and it was pretty obvious that there was confusion right from the beginning. You know, one group would go out, come back with its sketch maps, record its place names. Another group might go out 5-10 years later, come back with completely different names, you know, both claiming they'd collected these names from the local population, but names evolve, usage changes, and so President Benjamin Harrison in 1890 decided, okay, we need to form this board to get together and settle on one official name for federal use to cut down on any confusion. And even today, I mean, confusion would be an issue if you had search and rescue and you've got one name for a mountain on a federal map and you've got a different name on a state or county map and someone's calling, help, I've had an accident on a certain hill and, well, what's the name of the place? Where? Of course, now with GPS, it's a little easier, but you can't always get a cell phone signal up there on your mountaintop or even at the head of a remote creek in the woods. You might lose your cell phone. So if you're looking at a paper map, yes, people still use paper maps. If you have different names.
I do. I have one in my car.
Yes, I do too. So certainly, and the idea is to cut down on confusion and really just managing the land. Agencies, you've got all kinds of collaboration, environmental projects. We really can't be calling geographic places with different names. But again, the board's decisions are really only binding to the federal government, but at the same time, states and locals do typically rely on our names, and we really work very closely together to make sure we all have the same name for the same place.
May have been President Benjamin Harris is one of his biggest accomplishments, but that's for another program when we're talking about history.
Yeah.
But the other part of this, as I mentioned in the introduction, is that those 5% of named waterways tend to be cleaner and get more attention from residents. Why is that?
You know, I've heard that sort of anecdotally over the years, and it's interesting. Actually, Pennsylvania has one of the most sort of keen interests in applying names to preserve streams. Every once in a while, we get a cluster of sort of name that stream competitions, and Delaware County, Chester County have both been very active in the past on name that stream contests, and they involve the local, maybe the local school children, perhaps, you know, get them interested in local history, learning how to read a map, going out and traipsing along the stream to find a name. And if you can get the young people right from an early age thinking about a stream and its importance and how it maybe flows down into the Susquehanna and then eventually into the Chesapeake Bay and into the ocean, and how, you know, they may not think about the little bit of trash they dump into the water and behind their school, or, you know, when they're out playing. But if they understand the significance of streams in general to the environment, and then if they can sort of almost like adopt a stream by giving it a name that they've researched, that they've, again, looked into the local history, it certainly seems to be the case in Pennsylvania especially, but really nationwide, that, you know, just calling something tributary ABC or Stream 1 just doesn't have the same emotional attachment to a place that you have a name, especially if you can say, well, I was part of naming that, and who knows, 30 years from now, those children can tell their children that I was part of the process to name that. And certainly in Pennsylvania, too, more in the central part of the state, you'll see there was so much damage done to streams, you know, the coal mining and other industry, and it does seem that people like to adopt a stream and give it a name so that it has some, again, some sort of official recognition, and it does seem to make people want to take care of it.
Hmm.
And if part of that is cleaning it up, then, of course, it's a wonderful secondary benefit.
We have an email here from Dr. Shirley Clark, who is a professor of environmental engineering at Penn State Harrisburg. She says, I agree that name streams are better protected and can be more easily engaged the public. However, what we forget is that many streams were named. We just lost their names over the years. I look at the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection's map for impaired streams, and I see unnamed tributary.
Mm-hmm.
But if I look at the history of my borough and the records from the early 1900s, the streams all have names. As an example, in Middletown, the stream that goes through the center of the borough is listed as unnamed, but the 1900 sewage permits call it Bloody Run, so it has a name. To the west of it is Crawl's Run. I use these historic names in my presentations. The first step should be to find out which of these streams already have names that have been forgotten, and then label the maps and use the names. That touches on some of the things that you've talked about, but the point that Dr. Clark makes there about some that have had names mm-hmm. that have been forgotten,
mm-hmm.
is that part of the research?
Absolutely, yes. And we like to say we're a very reactive board. That is, we don't go out looking for features to name or rename. But certainly, if a name comes to our attention, or if somebody proposes a new name for what they believe to be an unnamed tributary, the very first thing we're going to say is, have you checked the local history? Have you checked the Department of Environmental Protection stream list? Have you done your homework? Because you're absolutely right. We don't want to innocently or naively apply a new name when, in fact, there is exactly an existing name out there that should be recognized. And so certainly if Dr. Clark has a list of names that we do not list currently in our database or not shown on those USGS topographic maps, I absolutely encourage her to send them in. We'll take them 1, 2, 20, 300, whatever she has. We'd love to record them because then that they become official for federal use. And then 5 years from now, if somebody says, I want to name this unnamed tributary, we can check and say, oh, no, it already has a name. And one thing we pride ourselves on in our database is every single name has a citation. So if she can submit those names with the source, that 1901 map that has the name, we will know 5, 10 years from now where that name came from. Not to say it couldn't necessarily be changed in the future, but she's absolutely right. We want to record the names that exist already and not introduce yet more confusion by applying a brand new name. So we love to work with the local communities to receive and should we say, process these names. And if we determine that map is an authoritative source, a published map. Yes, they should have been recorded 30 years ago. She's absolutely right. But we're here to record them now if we can. So I would encourage her to get in touch with us. Absolutely.
Bloody Run. I hate to think how that stream got its name. All right. So here's the point where we talk about the process.
Mm-hmm.
For those out there who are thinking, okay, I'd like to check. I want to find out if this has a name, and they want to name. I mean, they can name a waterway after almost anything, right? What's the process?
Well, yes, we do have a process, certainly. We have an application form. It's both available online and good old paper form that someone can complete and mail in. The idea is they need to obviously first of all identify the stream they want to name, you know, give us some geographic coordinates or mark up a map or let us know what it, so we can first of all just double check that it doesn't have a name already. And that's one of the challenges. It's not really easy for the average person to find an unnamed stream or to even really check to see if a feature has a name already. So I would suggest if they're not really sure if it has a name to reach out to us. We can check our database and just essentially what I do is I map all the ones that are named in the immediate area and I look at the map and say, okay, that one doesn't appear to have a name on it. We'll call it unnamed. So the first thing is identify the feature that needs a name. And then, of course, they've got to come up with a proposed name. It's not for us to suggest names or even pick from a list. They need to come up with a name, and they need to also really have a need to name. Now, you know, the need is such a broad definition, but not just honoring Grandpa that settled there, you know, 100 years ago. Ideally, Grandpa should have made some contribution to the community, should have, you know, Pennsylvania has a lot of these century farms, so we see names for families that have been there for 100 years or more. Maybe he served on the school board or did something, even if he just helped preserve the stream. A name sort of evolved by becoming, oh, that's the old Smith place. That's the, you know, the Smith Creek because it was on the old Smith farm. And so the name sort of becomes known locally as, oh, that's the Smith place. So Smith Creek might be the proposed name. We really discourage names that are simply, I hate to say frivolous, but there needs to be some reason for naming that stream, some reason for the name itself. We really like geographic and historic names, a name that ties into the local history. Maybe there was an early an event that happened there, a story you want to tell with that name. And it needs to be a name that's meaningful to the community, not just your own personal history. We get too many proposals for Engagement Lake. It's where a young man, you know, engaged, you know, proposed to his, you know, girlfriend. And yes, it's a wonderful idea, and it's special to him, but not to anybody else. You know,
yeah, but there are official lover lanes out there.
And that's true. Yeah, we do say we don't name roads or highways at all. There's just too many of those. We leave those for the local community. But certainly, yeah.
And living people, I understand that
no people
who are living, yeah, that you can't suggest a name of someone who is living.
No, exactly. The person has to be deceased at least 5 years and should also have had some association with that particular geographic feature or at least to the community, you know, made some contribution to the community. I will say the commemorative names in general are probably the toughest to get through the process. There's sort of a bar you have to reach to demonstrate that a person needs to be honored in that way. There's so many other ways to honor somebody, you know, special in your family. You know, a local scholarship, you know, local library branch, whatever it may be, but a school gymnasium. But naming a geographic feature is rather a big deal, and we take it seriously, and it needs to be a name that will stand the test of time, that we will look back years later and say, okay, that name honored a family, again, or an event, or an incident, some piece of the local history. Involve the community, do your research, and as Dr. Clark said, you know, check the old maps first. If you want to propose a name, be absolutely sure it doesn't have a name already, because those can be the awkward ones where we, again, assume a feature is unnamed, and then we find out later it actually had a name, and then we have to tell the person, well, now your proposal is a name change. Do you really want to pursue this?
Yeah.
So but as far as the process, yeah, they complete the application form, submit it, whether it's online or by mail. We do some initial investigation, just, again, verify it doesn't have a name, make sure that the geographic coordinates make sense. Do we know where the stream is? And then we prepare a case brief, which is essentially a summary of all the material submitted by the applicant and anything that we have found in our research. We have what we call a quarterly review list, which is where we post all the new proposals we've received those previous 3 months that goes online. And then we start our outreach. And I said in the beginning, local acceptance is so important to our board. So the staff spends a lot of time communicating with township and borough and county governments. We say, here's a proposal submitted by most likely one of your own constituents. Please review it. Keep in mind some of these policies, again, commemorative names. Do you think the person is worthy of the honor? If it's a historical name, can you also check your local records, local government, make sure it doesn't have a name already? And then give us a recommendation. Do you support this or not?
Jennifer Runyon is senior researcher with the U.S. Board on Geographic Names. Interesting topic. Thank you very much, Jennifer, for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, too. Also, have a good day.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. This month, the U.S. Mint will release the Women's Suffrage Centennial Silver Dollar Coin, celebrating the milestone 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. A Philadelphia-based artist was commissioned to design the coin that pays tribute to women integral to the suffrage movement. Appearing on today's program to discuss the design process and her membership in the U.S. Mint's Artistic Infusion Program is Professor Christina Hess. She designed the coin and is chair of the Illustration Department at the Pennsylvania College of Art and Design in Lancaster. Ms. Hess, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Scott. I really appreciate being here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. I have to say, you know, this is so interesting because I get the sense that this is just something that people take for granted, that we have coins in our pocket. Of course, now we're told not as many coins as what there should be, but right. We have these coins in our pocket, and I just wonder if people think, who designed this? Who came up with this? Tell us about the process that you went through in designing this coin.
Well, sure thing. So, as an illustrator, you know, part of the challenge and the joy of taking on a job like this is trying to figure out how to basically visualize and show a visual of something so immense like the women's suffrage movement and the 19th Amendment. So it was definitely an undertaking, but I'm a big history buff, and it was actually a real joy to go in and research all the women and the span of time that this movement, when it started and when it was ratified. So first is the research, definitely. So after the Mint contacted me and actually several other artists to come up with some designs, you know, we all are given some art orders. So basically, they give us some suggestions. They don't direct us in a very particular way. They want our vision. But at the same time, they give us great resources, too. So after I received those documents and did a deep dive on the internet onto historical sites and different sites on biographies of all these women and learn more about the movement and the span of it, then it's a matter of trying to figure out, okay, where visually do I want to go? So here I am with all these wonderful stories from, you know, Ida B. Wells and Alice Paul, Lucy Burns, and, you know, all of these amazing women who were part of this movement. And to break it down image-wise, it's a little more difficult because there's so many years involved. So what I wanted to do is I definitely wanted to make sure that I was covering, you know, the 1800s into the 1900s and, you know, kind of diversifying the women that were portrayed on the coin. So I went into the actual hats and the fashion, you know, aspects because that really tells a lot about the time period back then. So using different women for ages and ethnicity, as well as putting, you know, different types of fashion elements on their heads was also a way of kind of, you know, emulating the time period and the span of this movement. So going through and finding imagery, usually online, in books. I do a humongous research on posters of the time. So I did a lot of research on, you know, the different collateral that the women's suffrage movement would put out for marches and pins and different things of that sort. And after I kind of got some idea of just the, I should say, conceptual idea of what I would put in there, then I actually found public domain photos of women, usually historical photos of women. And because they're public domain, they're, you know, they're free for everybody to use, so I would draw from them and just kind of, you know, make tweaks on each of the faces so they're just a little bit different than the photos, and, you know, just basically have their own personalities, I guess you could say. And then after I draw it all out, I scan it in, I put it into Photoshop, and I rearrange things, add some type, and then I actually take it into another computer program called Corel Painter, where I paint everything. And because this is for coin design, it's black and white. So, you know, we don't have to dive into the color spectrum for this. With the reverse, what I really enjoyed about that was because there was no figures on the reverse, I really wanted to focus in on the time period of when the actual ratification happened, which was the 20s, which is an extraordinary, you know, visual bomb, I guess you could say. There's so many things with Art Deco and a lot of different fun elements to work with. So I really wanted to bring that in because I thought that looking at the front side, you're taking the span and the diversity of the time periods, but then on the flip side, you see when it was actually ratified, which was the 20s. So that's kind of where I went with it. Wow. And go ahead.
I have to tell you that I've been fortunate enough to see that I've seen a photograph of both sides of the coin. And I have to say that I probably have never described a coin as gorgeous, but it is when you think, when you consciously look at it and think of it. But you're right, the hats from the different time periods really do stick out as one of the features that a lot of people will notice right off the bat. Now, is this a coin? It's a silver dollar. It goes on sale next Tuesday, the 18th of August, in commemorative sets. Will it be in circulation?
I don't believe it will. It is possible for it to be in circulation. So if you were to take the coin, you can buy something with it, but it is legal tender, in other words, but it's more of a collector's item. So it is a dollar coin. So if you were to use it, you know, you would use it as a dollar. However, I believe it costs $65 to get. So you would get your money's worth if you use it in circulation.
Of course, there may be a time with with inflation and everything. Who knows? But you know, this is an interesting process that you just described. And like I said, I'm sure many people in our audience don't realize how much work. I'm curious, how many different designs you went through the process of how you came up with the final coin, but were there different designs that you considered, and how long of a process was this?
Oh, absolutely. So usually when I start off, I start with many, like, thumbnail sketches, which are just really, really rough sketches, and I probably usually come up with about 50 sketches for each idea, and then I narrow it down. So when I submitted my designs to the Mint, I narrowed the obverse down to two designs and the reverse down to two designs. Now, I was also within a really big group of other artists who also submitted for this particular coin. I was just really, really lucky and fortunate to get chosen, to have my designs chosen for it. So usually what happens is once you submit your work to the Mint, they put it together and they give it to a committee, and there are no names involved, and, you know, it's just the imagery, and the committees go through everything. This particular coin, there were a lot of committees involved, including the Smithsonian and the women's group at the Smithsonian, as well as two other separate committees. So there was a lot of eyes that went through all of these designs. But yeah, in order to get to that one image to submit, it's a lot of legwork.
It sounds that way. And I have to commend you because the final product is just, I think that a lot of Americans will appreciate it. It does go on sale. It's the Women's Suffrage Centennial Silver Dollar Coin. Christina Hess, who is chair of the Illustration Department at Pennsylvania College of Art and Design in Lancaster, designed it. Ms. Hess, thank you very much for being with us today. And congratulations.
Thanks so much for having me. Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to answer your COVID-19 questions.